Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri, our entomologist. He has lots to talk about today. Can visit about particular ant swarms during late summer afternoons. We can talk about magnolia scale, fall webworm, and, of course, take your bug questions as well. Join in the conversation. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Phil Pelletieri, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
It's been hot and humid, even though some strong storms have come through. We got a couple of nice days in southern Wisconsin, but with all that hot weather and the strong storms, has this weather affected our insects?
Always. You know, whatever weather scenario, you can pick things that do well and things that don't. You know, I get nervous about the kind of semi-drought conditions putting stress on plants. That often results in the plants being weakened, and so we get a lot more wood borers down the road that we will, you know, you'll see the plants start to show signs of stress next year, and we'll equate it to it being weakened this year. I've been a little surprised we haven't seen as many spider mites as I normally see when things get this dry, and we're getting late enough in the season that probably won't go anywhere. Little nervous about chinch bugs, and I talked to PJ a little bit about this in the lab, because it's been the kind of weather that chinch bugs do well in lawns. We haven't seen a lot of reports, but sometimes it's hard to sort through what is drought stress and what is chinch bug feeding. And so, as I said, we kind of keeping our eyes open on that, but so far it has not gotten as nasty as you might expect, considering, again, how dry we have been.
Yeah. You know, it's common to see ant swarms in late summer afternoon. What's going on there?
Well, you know, the swarming is really the mating going on when the new queens and the males are wing forms are leaving. And different ants swarm at different times of the year. In the late summer, the two big swarmers are cornfield ants, which we all have out in our backyards. Those are the ones that make the very tiny mounds. And usually it's about 4 or 5 in the afternoon, and you will just sometimes see clouds of insects flying off the ground. This will go on till about 7 or 8. Sometimes it attracts a lot of birds or dragonflies, those kinds of things. And then it just shuts off, and then it goes the next day. And if you have a rainy day, you might not see any activity. The other ant that swarms in the late summer are field ants, and these are the ones that make the very large mounds. And same type of thing. It's a bigger ant in comparison, but in all cases, this is a normal phenomenon, nothing to worry about. And both those ants are really not the type of ant that comes indoors. What's somewhat fascinating is that, you know, our native ants are very seasonal in when they will swarm. The ants that do not belong here, like pavement ants, swarm all the time. You know, any time of the year, it's a possibility. And so that's one of the things that distinguish when people start seeing swarms. The time of the year sometimes indicates to us what kind of ant it could be.
Yeah. Are ants beneficial insects?
Well, a lot of ants are predators, you know, and they feed on various insects that we would consider plant-damaging insects. So that part, yes, definitely. And, you know, the nuisance of them coming indoors, I mean, ants don't spread any diseases and those kind of things. So it's just more of a bother. And, again, a whole bunch of ant species don't have any interest in coming inside our houses and the like. Now, there are some side effects. Some ants can cause some soil disturbances, and in some cases, literally, will kill plants on purpose because the plant might shade their nest and they want to do a temperature regulation. That's pretty minor. You know, I usually don't worry about that, and it's only very specialized conditions that we get into that problem.
One pest we don't like to see very much is the fall webworm. Maybe talk about what are they and when are they going to be coming out?
Yeah, well, you know, the good news, at least from my running around in the southern part of the state, I've not seen a lot of webworms. And, you know, when you see webbing in trees in the spring, it is the eastern tent caterpillar. When you see it from July on through August, it's fall webworm. And I think the important point to me is that even if they were numerous, when you defoliate a tree in the late summer, it has far less impact on the tree than when you defoliate in the spring. And the problem is when you defoliate it too early, like gypsy moth might do or tent caterpillar, the tree will leaf out again, and it's burning a lot of energy to do that. Whereas if you talk about this fall defoliation, you know, the plants have done pretty well. They've stored a lot of the nutrients they need to. And so really, it's totally a cosmetic damage, you know, and less important. And so I think that's the important point. And as I said, whatever the dynamics, I have not seen a lot of fall webworm. They would be finishing up now anyway. And, you know, we talk about those kind of treatments that they've already done the damage. You know, your control methods aren't going to affect the population for next year. And, you know, you can argue it's a revenge treatment, but it really isn't justified as far as what's going on with the plant health.
You mentioned gypsy moths. You know, I saw egg masses in my neighborhood, a few at least. What's the status with them? Do you know?
Well, yeah, you know, in the years it's been in the state, you know, the populations really didn't explode as much as one might have thought. And this happened out east, too. And the main factor was a fungus disease. The problem with the fungus disease is it requires a lot of moisture in the spring. So if we get normal spring precipitation, we get a lot of natural control. With as dry as things have been, it's not surprising we're seeing more egg masses because they've been more successful in maturing and laying eggs. And now the big question is when you start putting two or three dry years in a row, then you set up the potential for having more of an outbreak. So it's a little early, but it's, you know, seeing more egg masses now in DNR and whatnot. We'll be doing some surveys, I'm sure, in areas will give us a little better picture. But I'm not surprised that the egg mass numbers are going to be up considering the weather conditions.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest, questions for him, give a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email us to ideas@wpr.org. Joan in Boaz, we'll give you a chance, or I'm sorry, John in Boaz, we'll give you a chance. Hi, John.
Good morning. I'm a listener. My father was a science teacher, so I have one question about how does a spider pump spider blood through those long legs? And if you know any of the status of the history of the Asian ladybug.
Okay. Let's start with the ladybug first, then we'll get to the spider thing. There's been a lot of confusion, and sometimes some of the news reports really have not been very accurate. The multicolored Asian lady beetle was released numerous times in the 1920s and in that era as a biocontrol agent for various pests. And to be honest, there was never an instance where it was successful. The last introductions were sometime in the 80s. I don't remember the exact date. In Georgia to control aphids in I think, peaches. Again, no evidence of success. The critter started showing up in New Orleans in the early 90s. And the evidence there suggests that it probably was a hitchhiker on a boat or some other form of transportation. And then you can track it spreading very quickly. I mean, it was up in Wisconsin by the mid 96, 97, I think, as we started getting activity. And, you know, it has exploded from there. When it first got here, it was competitively displacing or pushing out our native species, among other things. And, of course, its claim to fame is it invades people's houses in the fall. The problem is many people said, you know, we brought this into control, soybean aphid. Well, it was here 7 years before soybean aphid was ever found in the United States. Again, the evidence suggests that USDA and the other people that released it were not guilty in this case. You can't draw the line to New Orleans and in Louisiana where it went. So it looks like an accidental introduction, but you can argue as biologists, you know, the people that were releasing it, maybe not so much in the 20s because we didn't know better, but by 1990, using a generalist predator like this for bringing it in for control is kind of asking for non-target effects and the like. So as I said, you know, in general, the numbers are not as high as they were. And this was a common phenomenon I saw throughout my career of invasive insects that come in here usually are the most problematic initially. when they are not really in much of a balance, and things get better over time. They don't go all the way away, unfortunately, but I have not seen near the numbers as I did in the late 90s and early 2000s. Now, the spider thing, I'm not a spider expert, but insects, you know, are limited, and their relatives are limited in how big they can get because of their poor circulatory system. You know, blood or body liquids would pool in the bases of their feet and stuff. So if they're as big as a person, there's just no way they could move things around. And so that's why they're limited to those, you know, 3 or 4 inch giant beetles that you see in the tropics and the like. Now, when you contract muscles, there is a way of moving some body fluids. There are some muscular flaps. And there is a dorsal vessel, which is a heart-like structure on the top of it. But it's still kind of an interesting scientific phenomena that they can be as efficient as they are, even though they're small, of getting enough body fluids moving in and out. Now, you know, insects generally are kind of straw-like, or all arthropods are, you know, hard outer shell on the outside, not near as dense inside. That aids a little bit, but it still is really quite interesting how, without any active circulatory system and any major pumps in the legs, that they are able to move things around as well as they do.
Thanks for that question. Let's go to Perry in Mosinee. Hi, Perry.
Thanks for that question.
Let's
go to Perry in Mosinee. Hi, Perry.
We're having trouble hearing you, Perry. You may have to try to call back because we're just not getting your voice very well. Or at least I'm not.
I'm having the same problem.
Okay, let's Perry try again. Maybe get a different line. Ed in Linden Station. We'll go to you. Hi, Ed.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call. I have a small one-room cabin just outside of Linden Station. And this spring, I would come in after being gone for a while, and the floor would be kind of littered with ants. And I thought they were dead, so I'd sweep them all up, and then they would start to wiggle. And so it seemed like they weren't really dead. They were just laying there. And, you know, that happened quite a bit in the spring, and then there's a lot less. And then lately I've seen just a few of them, and I thought they were flies at first because they're kind of curled up and they have wings, but it turns out that they're ants. So I'm just wondering what might be going on there.
Yeah. You know, so any winged ant is technically a swarmer or a reproductive. And when I start seeing winged ants indoors in the fall, in the winter, in the early spring, it usually is carpenter ants, and they are swarming. And when they exactly come out is influenced a little bit by temperatures. And they would be somewhat dormant if it was cool in the spring, and then as they warm up, you know, or again, if you heated the cabin and it warmed up to a temperature that could get them active, that might explain part of it. Carpenter ants usually swarm in May and June. I mean, that's the typical time when we talk about in a totally natural setting. But I'm suspicious. And so how old is the building?
I would say that it's maybe 10 years old. It's quite new, actually.
Okay. So, you know, the two places carpenter ants get into is wood that has been water compromised. So, you know, that's usually an older structure. And, you know, the mistake is people think they eat wood, but they don't. They nest in softened wood, and so the wood has to be softened because of the water exposure. But they get into void spaces. They get into styrofoam. I mean, there's other environments they can invade. So even a brand-new structure has a potential for problems. I don't think I'd get overly concerned. I think, though, what I would do is play a little bit detective here to see if you can pick up any kind of pattern of where the ants might be. Sometimes you see a little bit of sawdust-like debris kicked out in a corner, and then I would look up above that, or, you know, if it's coming through a light plate, then, you know, you pull the light plate and see what kind of void space might be behind it. Because the whole secret is you got to find, if you can find the nest, you know, 2 squirts of any ant spray will solve the issue, because there's only one queen in that nest. But if you don't know where the ants are, any attempt you do to something is kind of like shooting in the dark. It really isn't going to solve this. So I'm not overly concerned about anything serious structural issues going on, other than, again, if you did have a big water problem, the water's the problem, not the ants. So I'd keep poking around in maybe even keep a little bit of a journal of what kind of activity. And I'll throw one other crazy one out at you. If you really, the ants are more active at night than during the day. And sometimes if you're going to spend a couple days at the cabin, maybe put out some honey or some cat food. In fact, to be honest, I think I'd use the sweet stuff now. The protein-based stuff works better in the spring. Put it on a piece of wax paper, and about 10 o'clock at night, what I'm hoping to see is a few ants coming to feed on it, but more importantly, once they got food, they had a beeline back to the nest, and you track them, you know, and if they head up the wall, you know that the problem's up there. If they head outside, then the nest is out there, although in your case, all the evidence suggests that they're in the structure somewhere. I don't think you wouldn't expect wing forms to come in from outside inside. That's kind of a dead ringer that there's a nest in the structure somewhere.
There you go, Ed. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. Our guest, Jane Rotunda, our on-air producer, Christina Myshock, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here taking a look at the world of insects with Phil Pelletieri. Phil, I think you can see the photos that have been sent up via email. One photo was of a, looks like a pretty large spider, brown and black legs with some white spotting on its body. What's that spider?
So, you know, I typically call it the black and yellow garden spider. But the bigger picture here is that at this time of the year, we have the adults of the orb weaver spiders. They generally are quite large. They generally are quite colorful. You can have oranges, you can have reds, bright yellows. And, you know, they have been out there all summer, but they were immatures and not near as showy as they are now. They do create these big orb webs that, you know, on a nice dew-filled morning, you can see out all over, and they will mate and lay their eggs, and their egg pod is how they get through the winter. But the big thing about the orb weavers is, again, their general bright colors and their large size get people's attention, but the good news is they're harmless to people, and they're very beneficial because they eat grasshoppers and all kinds of other critters and the like, and they also make great photographic subjects. I mean, this is the time of the year. For the next month or so, you will see them out there. And as I said, you can get some really neat pictures of them.
And Jim had emailed a photo. He can't recall ever seeing a bumblebee moth and wonders if that's what he's looking at. And are they native to Wisconsin? He also wanted to note that butterflies really love butterfly weed.
Yeah. We have two species in the group, Hemaris, which is the bumblebee mimics. I mean, they're looking like a bumblebee. They fly during the day, which is not what typical moths do. And they are black and brownish yellow in coloration. But unlike a bumblebee that jumps on the flower and crawls around when it's doing its thing, these things are always hovering. And that's why we often refer to them as hummingbird moths. This is one of the smaller species. There are bigger species that we have. And this particular one, the caterpillars feed on honeysuckle. And we got lots of honeysuckle out there. So, as I said, it is out there. But you really got to stop and look when things are going around the plants. Because, like I said, your first inclination is to just think it's a bumblebee and ignore it. But if you look closer, you may find they're a little more common than people think.
Pat in Madison, we'll go to you now. Hi, Pat. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a question about paper wasps. And I have a huge paper wasp nest at the top of my house. Are they beneficial, or do they have any predators?
Well, they have predators, they have parasites, but they're beneficial in the sense that depending on what species they feed on, caterpillars or house flies or other things, so they are predators. And the big thing, you know, if they're in an area that is away from people, so if you've got a two-story house and they're way up on the second floor, don't bother. They will freeze out, but probably not until getting the end of October. the only time you run a risk is when the nest is disturbed. And so, again, if it's right outside your front door and the mail person and you have to go by it all the time, then you say, well, we probably have to do something. But if it's in high up in a tree or, you know, on a big overhang in a place where people just aren't going by, it's much better to let them be. And they can be treated. I think the mistake people make if they have to treat them, you know, the various wasp sprays really are quite effective. But it's best to treat them really at dusk or at dawn. The problem when you treat in the middle of the day is the workers that are out and about come back and they get quite agitated, and so you're asking for trouble. But again, I find in a lot of cases they're in, just in places that it's best just to let them be. And as I said, they're you can argue the plus side of it because of the various plant pests that they feed on, that they would be considered beneficial in that sense.
Perry in Mosinee, he had lost connection with us, wanted to know about fathead worms and what he can do to get rid of them.
Okay, now you're getting in an area that honestly is not normally covered by an entomologist. I would have to see it. I don't think what he's talking about, I wonder if he's talking about planaria, which is often called flat-headed worms, but sometimes people refer to other things. And it gets really tough because, you know, there are no products registered for these kinds of things. And right away that, you know, it goes to slugs and snails. There are some products. Would they work against a flathead worm? Possibly, but I don't even know. And technically, again, you're kind of getting in uncharted waters. So I might have to delay in answering that one again without seeing it. If he's got a picture of the critter, it'd be worth sending it to PJ Leash at the UW Diagnostic Lab just to verify what the critter is. And then PJ might be able to dig a little bit more. But as I said, you're getting into a very gray area because earthworms in particular don't have products generally registered for controlling them. Snails only a couple products, and they don't respond to insects. In flat-headed worms, as I said, if it is planaria, I know there's no products straightforward that are registered for it.
Let's go to Maddie in De Pere, Wisconsin. Maddie, hi. What's on your mind?
Hello. I thought I heard the guest say that the ants could carry disease. What kind of diseases do they carry?
No. The other way, they do not carry diseases. There's just nothing that we worry about.
Okay, so we're good there. Thanks, Maddie. That gets that straightened out. Let's go to Lynn in Madison. Hi, Lynn.
Hello. This happened about 2 weeks ago that I had a swarm of houseflies in my house, which I would estimate 600 to 800 flies on all my windows. And I went through all the garbage and everything. There was nothing in there. And I killed them all that day. And in 2 weeks since, I haven't had a single one. And I'm just wondering what that was all about.
Yeah, to be honest, my first inclination is they were not true house flies because there's so many flies that look like house flies that are not. Without seeing them. So it's the wild guess. You know, usually when we get explosions of flies indoors, they're either flesh flies or bottle or blow flies, which are associated with something that died. You know, in the way flies attack a dead animal, they lay their eggs very quickly, and everybody kind of develops together and emerges at the same time. What's a little weird, though, is usually when you get this, even though you get an explosion of flies, it often will last for 4 or 5 days, you know, until the food's exhausted, they all matured. And then they're gone. I'm guessing it a little bit, and it would have been nice if you had a picture or a fly to look at. But that kind of phenomena is, as I said, often associated with a quick source of food. And, you know, house flies could come from garbage. They tend to get in a little bit more people-type food, decaying people-type food. But usually for that kind of number, you would think that your nose would tell you something was amiss, you know, because, of course, the kind of things they get into are pretty disgusting and the like. So, yeah, too bad you didn't have the picture. It's a little early for cluster flies, and they wouldn't behave quite that way. So that one is out. And, that's my best guess.
All right. There you go, Lynn. Thanks so much. Let's turn to Marilyn in Ellison Bay. Hi, Marilyn.
Good morning. I just read today in a mailing from the Environmental Defense Fund that the impacts of climate change are showing up as shorter and smaller wings on our monarch butterflies, and that they extrapolate out could affect their migration, which, of course, has already been a problematic thing. And I'm just wondering, this is the first that I've heard about the wing size being compromised.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm not aware of that particular one. You know, the first thing that, you know, taking a step back is you wonder if it's nutrition related, because when you start stressing insects, they do come in smaller sizes. Is the climate change affecting that aspect of it? I mean, that would be one thing I think you'd have to look at. I know reading about some migrating monarchs down in Florida, that things are getting all out of whack again because of climate change and certain plants being around later causing the monarchs to stick around. So, you know, I'm not surprised that we're seeing effects, especially negative effects, but that particular one, as I said, other than relating it to stressing the caterpillars because of food quality, that would be my first suspect cause of why the monarchs are smaller.
All right, Marilyn, thank you so much. Lori in Shawano, we'll go to you now. Hi, Lori.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment on the paper wasp, too. I had a house that I moved in from into this one, and that house had paper wasp nests all around the soffit. And now here, I get them on my north deck on the railing, and I have some also on the soffit on the north above the north deck, and I've never had an issue with them. They never seem aggressive at all. Now, last summer, I did have maybe what they call ground bees, and they were buzzing all around this my south deck, and they were horrible. I got stung by them. Luckily, the night that after I got stung, some little critter came in under my fence and got rid of the nest, but it was like 2 weeks later, these paper wasps took over on each railing on my deck, and I can hit that railing, I can put my feet up on it, and they really don't respond to that.
Yeah, I, you know, generally speaking, what I find is vibrations. You know, lawnmowers, hedging, you know, things tend to get them a little more aggravated. And the species you have in the ground, if I had to take a guess, is just a ground nesting paper wasp, and they have much bigger colonies. You know, it can be 2,000-3,000 individuals, whereas the paper wasps that make their little nests underneath overhangs and the like come from a genus we call Polistes, and then you're often talking only 20-30 individuals, and they're somewhat docile, but I have still been stung by them. You know, you find sometimes you know, even what the temperature, how much sunlight, all those things affect their disposition, which is really quite curious. The same thing with honeybees. And so sometimes, you know, cooler days and whatnot, and again, with you just being there and not really doing something that they feel threatened, they don't react to. I don't say that about the ground nesters, only because typically what happens, it's people mowing lawns and other things that go by, or, you know, we have unfortunate cases where people are walking, and because they are nesting in a ground hole or void, where all of a sudden you put your foot down and you just break right through. And of course, you know, breaking right in the nest, you can see where they get very agitated. So you do have to be careful. And this is the time of the year when the ground nesting paper wasps numbers are highest, and they will be quite active for the next 6 weeks or so. Whereas earlier in the season, the numbers were much lower. You know, we're talking, you know, 20, 30 individuals, not thousands like you could have, and that's why you don't see the problem. It's more of a late summer, early fall issue to be careful. But yeah, you kind of evaluate what they're active, and if they tolerate your activity out, you know, on the porch and the deck, no need to really do anything, I don't think.
Thank you for that call, Lori. Joe emailed just relating to this. He has a swarm of bees, he says, that are entering and exiting a hole in the sandy dirt at the base of his house foundation, wonders how to get rid of them.
Okay, so, you know, if it was honeybees, and, you know, when honeybees start colonies, it is a swarm, a cloud of bees, and you can sometimes see them attached to structures, And they typically look for a void space, some kind of hole, hollow tree in particular, but I do see them getting in attic spaces and the like. But as we mentioned, people often refer to as ground nesting yellow jackets as ground bees. And they're very different both in their temperament and where the problem lies. The thing with honeybees is their colony can live for years, so it does not go away. So if it's going in the house, you usually have to address it. And the best thing to do is if you can get a local beekeeper to come, they have ways that they can convince the bees to go with them. And so the bees get recycled, per se. It's also important if the bees were in the house structure, you've got to clean out the old wax and comb. If you don't, other swarms eventually may come back. They're attracted to old hives, per se. Now, if it's a ground nesting bee, okay, we've got a different issue. Again, depending on where it's located, if they're not coming indoors, they're not messing with people, you could conceivably leave it alone. But if you had to treat, rather than buying the aerosol sprays that work so well for the above-ground type of nests, I find using a garden dust, is the best way to go. And what you have to do is treat it right in the morning, when it's, especially a cool morning would be the best, or possibly, again, just as things are quieting down at night and the sun's going down, and you dust the entrance. And when they come and go, they get into the dust, and that's what does them in. So it's not an instant, they're done now, but it is far more effective than the aerosol sprays that really don't penetrate well enough. And so depending on the location, sometimes it's easy, you can just sprinkle it on. Other times you have to use like an old turkey baster or a mustard bottle, or there's something you get at a hardware store called a bulb duster where you put the dust in and you can blow it into that hole. Because that's what's critical, is that the dust coats the area, and then when the critters come and go, they get exposed to it. That's what does them in.
Let's take another call. Kristen in Bridge Creek, your turn. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, gentlemen. How are you today?
Great. Appreciate the call.
I have a fruit fly problem that I cannot get rid of. It's coming from our sink, and I don't have a garbage disposal. And my husband has been putting boiling water down the sink, and it does absolutely nothing. I tried a home remedy of salt and baking powder and vinegar. That did nothing. So I'm baffled at how to get rid of all these fruit flies, and they are definitely coming from my sink. And I've scrubbed underneath the sink. I've scrubbed everything. So mm-hmm. I hope you can help me.
Well, you know, there's about three or four little flies that you can get indoors. And honestly, knowing exactly which one it is somewhat important because it points you in the direction. True fruit flies, I do not expect to come. I've seen them come out of garbage disposals that have not been used for like 4 weeks, where you've got a bunch of, you know, orange peels and the like. So you've got a food source for them. And the thing about true fruit flies is it has to be decaying organic matter, but pretty fresh. And they're also called vinegar flies because often you have a vinegar smell because of the overly ripeness of what they're after. And in a normal sink, you just wash things through too much. Now, on the other side of things, there is something called a drain fly, which breeds on much more decayed debris that sometimes cakes inside the pipework and the like. There's also another critter called a small dung fly, which is another decaying organic matter feeder that's about the size of a fruit fly. Of the three, the drain fly, to me, seems to be the more likely. One would think, though, if you got boiling water and put it down, because the temperature associated with the boiling water, it would kill the larvae and basically solve the problem. So if that has not solved it, we got another source that's close by. And one would think that if you've had seepage or leakage or other kinds of problems with the sink, that would be apparent. But I think it'd be worth getting a couple flies. And again, if you can take a really good picture, you can send that to PJ and he can take a look, or you know, you can bring this stuff in the county extension office, and if they can't identify it, they'll send it down to PJ anyway. Just to get more at the heart of this, because as I said, it just isn't adding up, the kind of little gnat-type problems I see. Usually fruit flies, if we got a problem, stuff caked in garbage cans, recycling cans that are not washed out, are a source. And the problem is that you can see the adult flies around your bananas, but the breeding source is somewhere else. in again, normally a normal sink with normal running water and stuff just doesn't accumulate the organic matter to be a breeding source of any of those flies. So,
yeah, makes sense. Kristen, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's take a call from Dennis in Two Rivers next. Hi, Dennis.
Thank you, Larry. Hi, Phil. I was getting ready to mow my lawn about a month ago. I don't use any pesticides or any herbicides. And I was checking my lawn, and I noticed a couple of bumblebees a couple of feet from my house, and they were maybe two, 3 inches apart. And I don't know if maybe they might have been fighting or they might have bumped in my window, but they were having trouble flying. I was trying to figure out, well, how am I going to get them off my lawn so I can mow? And I don't know what might have been causing them to have trouble flying.
Well, you almost wonder if their days were numbered because of their age. You know, I mean, insects, you know, the way the life cycles go, when they kind of run out of energy, technically be deceased, I guess, or I mean, diseased, which also would stress them out. But they're definitely in a very weakened condition. And again, without being able to identify anything else, that would be what was going on. And about the only thing I could suggest, if you take a piece of paper or whatnot and just kind of brush them on it or some other kind of object and then just carry them away. I mean, bumblebees are very docile. And, you know, I wouldn't handle one in my hand alone because that may be a way of getting stung, but you'd almost have to go to that degree for them to be aggressive. And so, as I said, if there's any way you could just physically relocate them, but, you know, at normal circumstances, at normal temperatures, they should be able to fly just fine. So there's something more going on there.
Hmm. Dennis, thanks for calling. Nikki emailed. Nikki says this summer in Milwaukee, she's observed multiple black swallowtail butterflies laying eggs on her garden parsley and dill. She's seen 10 to 15 baby caterpillars after hatching on the herbs. However, after a few days, most disappear. She has had 4 to 5 of the caterpillars make it to the chrysalis stage. Are other insects or caterpillars or predators to newly emerged black swallowtail caterpillars?
Yeah,
and in
a whole
general, what would you say the average success rate is for native caterpillars to make it to the chrysalis stage?
Average success rate is probably between 2 to 5%, so it's pretty low. I mean, that's why insects have to lay so many eggs, because they have a hard time getting through. My first inclination is thinking it's wasps that are the predators that are picking the caterpillars. If you watch, a lot of times wasps will be searching and crawling around your plants, and that's what they're looking for, is caterpillars to take back. That's why, you know, for monarchs and these swallowtails, it's sometimes when you got them small, if you really want to get a bunch of them, you almost have to take them in and kind of raise them indoors to keep them away from those. I'm in the process right now. I've got a young neighbor. It's in first grade, and so we've given him a couple black swallowtails and a monarch, and the monarch has made a chrysalis, and that will emerge. But my guess is the black swallowtails that make a chrysalis this late will not emerge until next year. If you think about it, it would be a big mistake to come out now, try to lay your eggs, and have your caterpillars mature enough with as short a growing season as we have left. And so they're kind of conditioned. In order for them to develop properly, so, you know, you leave them where they are. If they come out in the next week or two, there's not much you can do. But if they do not emerge, then it's somewhat important to put them in a cool place for the winter, a garage or the like. It's not good to bring them indoors because if they don't get the cold shock, they probably won't develop properly. I mean, the part of the natural way of these things working is for the cold to condition them, and then they develop next spring and then emerge in May and June like you normally expect. And so, as I said, we're getting late enough now. And insects use day length, just like plants, on how to prepare for things. And so I think they're probably conditioned in the chrysalis stage not to emerge now because, as I said, we're getting pretty late in the year for that. And so, yeah, if you want higher numbers when they're small, you got to bring them in and kind of babysit them. Or just let things go natural. But that's pretty natural if you had 8 or 9, and there are probably more eggs than that laid initially, to only have 1 or 2 make it all the way through to the chrysalis stage.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest today, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus professor from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. With us on the Ideas Network, Larry Mueller here talking to Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison, and we're visiting, of course, about the world of insects. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234, email to ideas at WPR.org. And Phil, we had John emailed a couple of beautiful photos, one in particular. They're both of moths. One is a light green, the other a tan. And
yeah. He has what we would consider trophies. So the light tan one is a wild silkworm that we call Polyphemus. The green one with the tails is the Luna moth, which is another wild silkworm. And then the one in the middle is the white-lined sphinx moth. Now, sphinx moths are in that hawk moth family and group, like the bumblebee hawk moth that we talked about earlier. A great picture of it because it's, if you look close enough, you can see the proboscis going into the plant. The wings are you know, the speed was fast enough you could pick the wings up without them being blurred. Every once in a while, in certain years, we get large numbers of white-lined sphinx, and they're almost getting big enough that you can see how they're easily mistaken for hummingbirds. Their caterpillars feed on a wide variety of things, and you know, I've never quite understood the dynamic of what it takes for them to have a good year. I mean, they can be. I remember back in the 90s, they were so numerous, the caterpillars were, that we were getting complaints of them crossing highways and catching people's attention, and that, you know, that's pretty unusual. And then, of course, about 3 weeks later, you got all kinds of these things flying around, and they have two generations a year. From what I remember, but it's quite common to see them in August and early September hovering around on your plants. And so this is the time of the year, if they're going to be around, you might be lucky enough to see one.
Let's take a call from Pam in La Crosse. Hi, Pam.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about my milkweed plants. I just started some, and on the top of my milkweeds right now are these tiny, tiny little yellow insects. I don't know if that's some sort of an aphid, and
yes.
I'm wondering how I get rid of them.
Yeah, they're milkweed aphids. They honestly don't pose a lot of problems, I mean, at least as far as competition the interesting dynamic about aphids is if you're a patient person, there will be beneficial insects that show up and knock their populations down. Now, the general rule that I would work under is, you know, aphids tend to do well in the spring when the predators aren't out yet. They usually don't do as well in the summer, but you don't see milkweed aphid until, of course, the plants are bigger, and so this is quite common. We've got them out on our butterfly weed in low numbers. If they got to the point that the plants were drooping and showing other signs that, you know, they were really catching a bunch of stress, a soapy water spray would knock the aphids down and wouldn't leave any residual that would hurt much. But you can probably just let it be. As I said, I think they will come under natural control pretty quick.
And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it, Pam. Let's go to Tom in Portage next. Hi, Tom.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Looking for recommendations on natural ways to move bee and wasp population. We've got a fireplace with an air intake area that wasps seem to have made a home, and we're seeing wasps then come into the house through the fireplace. And we've got a cottage up in northern Wisconsin where we've got bees in riprap along the lake. I've read a little bit about peppermint oil mixed with water and soap. I'm wondering if that would work, or what other ways there would be to encourage these populations to move.
Okay, we're late enough in the year. I don't think there is a way of getting the populations to move. You know, in for most of these species, if you were trying to point them in a different place, I think you have to do it when the queens are active in the spring and basically prevent them from establishing right away. But once you've got an established colony, they're all about doing whatever they can to stay there and defend it. And so you've got a problem. Now, the fireplace thing is there any way that you because this has been a reoccurring problem, can screen it in a way that they can't get access, but yet you get the airflow that you need?
Yes, I could replace the screen that's on the vent to make it smaller, but wouldn't I just trap them inside then?
Well, yeah, no, this would be for next year. This year, it's probably best to let them be. And again, now what you've got to decide is if enough of them are finding their way in because they get mixed up and whatnot, then indeed you may have to consider, because of the risk involved of stinging and stuff, of dispatching the colony. It's just kind of a, you know, the worst thing that people can do, you know, when we have them go in the siding or going in the attic is plug the hole before we've dealt with them. And so usually what I would suggest to folks is you kind of, you know, weigh the fact that we've got maybe another 5-6 weeks of activity, and then the cold weather is going to kill them out, and they do not reuse the same nest. I mean, that we don't have those kind of wasps in Wisconsin. And so it will take care of itself. The only question is again, is there enough activity? And, you know, I've even seen people go to the point when it's a problem of duct taping, you know, their flu or something else, to just prevent access, or again, for ones that are in the wall, if they're coming through a light fixture, or a wall socket, you tape it in a way so that they stay out. And as I said, the only mistake could be is if you force them by plugging their coming and going entrance, force them into the house, then things get much more difficult to deal with.
There we go, Tom. Thanks. Don in Madison, your turn. Hi, Don.
Hey, Phil, can you hear me?
Yes.
We've got red beetles eating our Turk's cap lily and our Solomon seals lily. Never seen them before, but they arrived in great numbers.
Yeah, I have not seen it myself, but there is a lily leaf beetle that is invasive from Asia. In the original population started up in the Wausau area a few years ago, and I am real suspicious that's who you've got. And they're somewhat selective. I don't know the total host range. Honestly, they seem to prefer Asiatic lilies, but you know, it wouldn't surprise me them feeding. And they're in the leaf beetle family, the Chrysomelids. You know, again, this late is probably less critical for the plant health. But if you want to get after them, an organic treatment. There is a product called Spinosad is the fancy name. Dr. Jack's Dead Bug Brew and a few other products are out there that contain this. And this is derived from a natural fungus. And it is very effective against beetles. It doesn't kill all insects, but it works against beetles. And so that would give you an option. It's also pretty good against caterpillars. People use it on their broccoli to prevent activity on that. And so, but the bad news, I think, is this is going to be a reoccurring problem, at least from what we have seen. I know it's been established in the Milwaukee area for the last couple of years. And so, as I said, am I surprised it's gotten here? No. But that's, I bet you, who you've got is a lily leaf beetle.
Yeah, there you go, Don. Thank you. Jeff in Berry Mills, your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Yeah, just a quick question about the cicadas that you hear buzzing in the trees around here now. Are they related to the cicadas that we heard about earlier in the year with the big hatch coming every 17 years, or are these just a solitary type of cicada?
Yeah, so the ones that we get in the late, from July on, belong to a group we call dog day cicadas. And although they have a 2 or 3 year life cycle, there are some out there every year. So they're an annual occurrence. The ones that were so active out east and got all the press, different species, and there are both 17-year versions and 13-year versions. Wisconsin will get our 17-year version in 2024. More in the south, east part of the state, doesn't quite get to Madison, although there is activity along the Wisconsin River. And that will get a lot of press because it's also very active in the Chicago area. So you'll see similar kinds of press reports. Not as big as this one out east. The eastern population that came out in the D.C. area and whatnot is the one that always gets the most interest because of the large geographic area with high populations it is. So they're in the same group of insects. They are close relatives. You could probably consider them cousins. Might be a good way of referring to the 17-year variety And again, these dog day cicadas, of which we have at least three species of that, and then we've got a couple other ones. I think totally we're on about five or six species of cicadas in the state that you could potentially run into. But the dog day cicadas are the ones that go, and if you pay close attention, you can identify them by their song. University of Michigan used to have a great website, I think it's still there, where you can listen to the various sounds of the various species of dog day cicadas and identify them. And it's kind of fun because, again, if you pay attention, you might be blessed with more than one kind in your neighborhood.
Very, very cool. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for that question. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, entomologist and distinguished faculty associate emeritus at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, our guest today, and he'll be with us right up till 12:30. We are going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with Phil. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking about insects today with Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. Always great to have him stop by. Questions about an insect? I hope you'll join in. Our lines are all filled right now, and so are our emails. So I think we'll go back to the phones. Nancy in Waukesha, I believe it's your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm calling about stink bugs. Last year we had quite a few of them that were surrounding the perimeter of our house, hanging on the screen doors, and some of them actually got into the house, and we were killing stink bugs all winter long. That wasn't very pleasant. So can you predict what we might expect this year? And is there a way for us to kind of protect against their infestation in this coming season?
Sure. A little early to call, but once you start seeing them congregating in the next couple of weeks, it will give you an idea what their populations are like. And this is a relatively new phenomenon. This is the brown marmorated stink bug, which is an Asian species, went crazy in the Pennsylvania, New Jersey area initially and has been now in the state for a good 10 years or so. And so the numbers are slowly building. I noticed a handful might be the best way in our household last year. So nothing very numerous, but, you know, you do get reports. And if you go on the internet, you will see pictures of houses just absolutely covered with them and people having, you know, 2 and 3 gallon pails of ones swept up. Like all fall invading insects, the best solution, the long-term solution, is to tighten things up on the outside so they can't get in. So you check your soffit vents and any cracks and in any place where you've got ductwork or piping coming out, making sure things are sealed around it, because it doesn't take much for them to squeeze in. And the argument there is that if you solve the riddle of how they're getting in, you've got a permanent solution. And sometimes it's apparent. I mean, if they always show up in the bathroom, I always would tell people, check your bathroom vent outside from the fan to see if that might be the weak point. So sometimes the pattern gives it away. But what gets tricky is once they get in your walls and get your attic, then they're going to filter down throughout the house and light fixtures and all those other things. And so it's harder to read. And once you let them get inside, there is no magic. You know, there's nothing you can do, no sprays or anything else that can make a difference because they're hiding in the walls and you're not getting to them. So as I said, we first try to approach it by just getting things sealed, caulked, tightened as best we can. If that doesn't work, and you know, this is more typical in an older structure that just has so many openings, people do apply chemicals on the outside when they start invading. So that is the end of August into September. Unfortunately, the stink bugs don't respond quite as well as the Asian lady beetles and cluster flies, which are other fall invading insects, but it still works to some degree. And so, as I said, now is the time to start looking. And think about them when you watch them. They're down low on the siding, and they crawl upwards. So those are the kind of seams they're looking for. I usually don't get too nervous about ground level, you know, first foot or two in the house. Or earwigs and whatnot, that would be the weak point. But for things like stink bugs, they're going up. And as I said, hopefully you can come. Now, you know, maybe we will bless in the next couple of weeks you won't see any. I will tell you, I have been somewhat pleasantly surprised that their numbers didn't take off here as fast as they did out east, which makes me wonder if they may not get quite as problematic. The other kind of giveaway, you know, because they feed on tomatoes and peppers and things, is sometimes people can tell in their gardens that their numbers are up because their fruits have been damaged by the stink bugs. And so if you haven't seen any of that, that would suggest that their numbers might be down this year. But a little early to tell, I think.
Thanks for calling, Nancy. Julie had emailed, speaking of pests, she's wondering about Japanese beetles. They seem to be destroying her plants. She had them for the first time last year and now again this year.
Yeah, so she is, I had a good conversation with one of my neighbors about this because, you know, about 20 years ago, they went bonkers in Madison. And to the point, people don't believe you. If you've not experienced it, it's like a science fiction movie because there is beetles on everything, and they've probably been feeding on her plants for the last 5 or 6 weeks. They love grapes. They love raspberries and the like.
Roses.
But, yes. But the interesting thing is, in my backyard, there isn't this year, I bet you I could have counted maybe 20 beetles total. And the numbers just fell off the cliff. But the unfortunate thing is for this listener, they just got in her neighborhood and things are going to be bad. And what's so frustrating about Japanese beetles is they're flying in from down the road. So there is no magic that you can do on your property that's going to make any difference. And so when their numbers are high and they're eating everything, you either have to physically keep them off with screening and those kind of things, or fight the fight with various sprays. But the dilemma with sprays is they last for a few days, and these things are literally active from the end of June, and depending on the given year, I've seen them well active into the middle of September. And so it just is a real unfortunate thing because the list of plants they feed on is so long compared to what a normal insect would do. And so a lot of things are susceptible. And as I said, this late in the game, I would not suggest to treat your lawn for Japanese beetles unless there were thousands of grubs there. And I don't see that. In my case, where we get all the beetles in our neighborhood is I've got a golf course 2 blocks away, and the golf course is the best breeding site for Japanese beetles. But even under those conditions, as I said, their populations will come into balance, but it's about a 7 to 10 year process. And you know, it may even be worse next year, but down the road it will get much closer to take care of itself. And so I get these things. We've got a friend out in the Dodgeville area, and again, they have just showed up in her rural neighborhood in the last couple of years, and she's in this, you know, population increase side of it, unfortunately. And again, you live on a 100-acre farm. What are you going to do? There's just nothing that's very practical.
Linda in Wausau, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Larry and Phil. My husband and I have been raising monarchs for about the last 4 to 5 years. We have a big swamp milkweed patch. And this year we tent them and leave them on our covered porch. And we've had about 450 chrysalis. And to date, we've released about 310. And I have a lot of butterfly nectar plants in our yard. And the butterflies stay around for just a very short amount of time. They tend to go to the top of the trees to power their wings, and then they're gone. And my question is, where do they go to join the migration? So we're in north central Wisconsin. Do they fly over to Lake Michigan, or do they somehow make their way to the Mississippi? Do you have any idea?
Well, I mean, it's kind of random, although you will see. So once in a while, you get the reports in the fall where they are roosting, you know, in at dusk, and literally thousands of butterflies will come in. And very often, you get those reports along the lakeshore. I think that is more influenced by wind patterns, you know, with the change of temperature of water and not. I was blessed back about 5-6 years ago when I was out bow hunting in September. all of a sudden the number of butterflies, even though I've hunted this property for a number of years, it was the only year I saw this kind of stunning population. When you're walking through next to the bushes, they would literally flush. And again, sitting up in the tree stand at night, I'm watching them roost in the tree next to me. And so I got some neat video and stuff. But even though I go back to that property all the time, that was just a phenomena then. So it's a little hard to predict where they're going to be. They're all going to start heading. Anything that emerges now is going to head. I will tell you, I'm very impressed with your numbers. That by far is the highest reproductive success I've heard, I think, which is really neat that you're releasing any. But, yeah, we're at that time of the year. And my observation in the Madison area, I've seen more monarchs this year than I remember in the last 4 or 5 years. And these are local populations of being active. What we'll start to witness now, though, is the monarchs migrating through. And so that'll give us some indication, I think, of what kind of success rate the populations had in our part of the Midwest. Of course, the bigger question is how they did throughout the nation, because things can vary quite a bit.
Yeah. Linda, thank you so much. David emailed, how large do crab spiders grow, and are there many species in our part of the upper Midwest? He sees them on white daisies, on goldenrod, and the yellow petals of black-eyed Susans. Are they like chameleons?
I don't think they can change color, but many of them have whites and pinks and other things that are reminiscent of flowers that I know. It's not a very big spider. There are some bigger crab spiders, but even, size of a nickel with the legs extended is about as big as the ones I see in Wisconsin. There are bigger ones in the tropics. And in particular, they sometimes refer to the ones that he's seeing as flower spiders, even though they are technically a crab spider. They're pretty small. I think about the size of my little fingernail would be the size that I would expect. And, again, great photographic subject. It's interesting, people's tolerance of spiders when they are attractive like that is much better than if they're just, little fuzzy black ones, and then they don't get as much love.
Oh, boy. Emma in the town of Dunn will give you a chance now. Hi, Emma.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because I've been on the property where we are right now for over 20 years, and this is the first year that we have had hornworm caterpillars. And so I'm wondering, was there a moth that came and laid some eggs, or how did we get them? And what do I do to prevent them next year?
Okay, so what plants were they feeding on? That'll help me tell which one it is. Okay.
Tomatoes.
So there is both the tobacco and tomato hornworm, and their claim to fame is they feed on tomatoes and other things in that family. My take on them is, you do get migrations up here in certain years. They are not, some insects like Colorado potato beetle, once they find your garden, they never go away. My experience with hornworms is it doesn't go that way. Now, you can argue that they have a chance. The way they get through the winter is the caterpillars will burrow into the ground, make their pupal case there, and then they emerge next year. Because you don't seem to see these reoccurring populations in any given garden, I don't think they do very well. And again, I think we probably get as many migrants, flying up here and starting it. You can make the argument that if you handpicked or in other way destroyed the ones that are there, you're reducing the population. But I just don't expect a problem. With that in mind, though, it is well worth, when we get into July, going out and just examine your leaves real closely to make sure there's not any little hornworms there. And it may just been you had one female that laid a bunch of eggs, and you're dealing with all her offspring that's been bothering your tomatoes this year. And as I said, the chance of that reoccurring to me is slight.
There you go. And by the way, we have a new blog post from our Tomato Garden Talk last week. It's about the drought and the heat and how they've been tough on tomatoes. And so if you go to our blog post, go to ideas@wpr.org/Larry and take a look at the blog post there. It's over on the right, I believe. You'll see that story. So I wanted to mention that. And also, there was quite a nice photo Well, there was a photo first of Jan emailed a photo of some dry grass nests on her windows. Every year from mid to late summer, they get these little nests of dead grass on the top of their crank out windows that have been closed for a while. The opening is too small for birds. Is this insect behavior?
Yeah. It definitely is a type of solitary wasp. And if you were to dissect those little piles of grass, there are probably crickets or possibly longhorn grasshoppers and the like, because that's the prey. And the way these things work is they're looking for a straw-like environment. So there must be some kind of opening that they can get squeezed through. They use the grass to kind of make a home, if you think of it that way. They provision the nest with their prey, which are these crickets and grasshoppers, lay their egg, and then they're gone. So it's not like a colony nest, like a paper wasp, where everybody's living together and whatnot. These things set up the situation, and then they're gone. For that reason, solitary wasps are very docile. They're not aggressive because there's no nest to defend is what the argument is. So, as I said, it's a very particular one. This comes from one of the Sphecodes, one of the thread-waisted wasps, and there's a number of different species. It's worth just kind of brushing out. The only thing I could say if this is really bothersome is kind of look very closely at the seams of that window when it's closed. There might just be a slight modification you can make that denies them access, and then you won't see this. Is it serious? No, nothing you have to worry about, but it definitely explains. I get this a lot in ventilation and weep holes, too, in windows, that little straw-like environment attracts various species, and there are smaller ones and bigger ones, and some use, you know, leafhoppers for prey and the like, but it's the same kind of story. They're just taking advantage of an environment that they can find.
Hmm. Janet in Marshfield. Hi, what's on your mind?
Hi. We have a very small patio that was put in about 2 years ago. However, this spring, a group of wasps decided that would be their place to make their nest, and we can't see how big it is because we put wire around it so the animals couldn't get under it. But the wasps go between the boards, and my husband's, well, he left them alone all summer, so it's probably a pretty big nest because he thought he'd leave them there for pollination, and then it got stung twice, and then there goes the pollination. So he sprayed the nest on Sunday night about midnight because he wanted it to be dark enough, and they came flying out the next day just like they hadn't been sprayed at all.
Did he know where the nest was? Could he see it when he sprayed?
No. You can't, even with a flashlight, he can't actually see where it is because of the way he's got the screen and all that stuff in it.
And see, that's the problem, is that if he hit the right spot, it would be successful, but without knowing where it is, I expect not to have success. And unfortunately, we're kind of caught, so you're caught in the situation of letting them die naturally, which is a good 5 or 6 weeks away, which will affect a little bit of your activity. You know, on real cool days, they're not going to be near as active, and they will start declining in population numbers once you get into early September, but they can still hang out. But, you know, the only other thing I've seen pest control people play with is if you restrict access. So in other words, you know, I don't know if you use some duct tape or other things. Painter's tape might even work until it rains. And plug off a lot of the openings so that there's only a limited area that they can come and go through. And then I would go to using these dust-type treatments because, again, when you dust that opening and they come and go through the dust, it does them in. So I don't know if it's worth that kind of effort, but that's the only way I can see of getting after them because, as I said, you've got to restrict their access so you know exactly where they're coming and going from, and then they're much easier to treat.
And thanks very much for calling, Janet. Appreciate it. Bob in Green Bay emailed, "It seems like we are always getting invaded by bugs from Asian countries. Do our bugs ever invade them?"
Yes. So, you know, the general rule is 2/3 of things that we define as pests are not native to North America. So they're insects out of balance. And if you go back 100 years ago, they were all European because that's who our trade partners were. And if you go in the last 30 years, it's all Asian. But yes, similar things. You know, humans have done a good job of upsetting the normal balance of things. And you know, so Colorado potato beetle is, you know, devouring stuff in Europe and the like. Asia has been attacked by some of our wood borers that attack their trees and the like. So, yeah, unfortunately, this is a problem. And to be honest, it's somewhat amazing that we don't have more problems, because with all the goods that are coming and going, you would think that there's more of a chance. So every year, you know, I anticipated seeing two or three new pests, per se, coming into the state. It's very predictable. Unfortunately, you don't know which ones are coming. And, you know, I'm sure there are many other species that come here, but they don't become pests. They don't establish, or they just don't compete with us for something we want. So we were being a little bit more accepting of it. But, yes, this has been one of the goof-ups that people have done throughout the world, is importing all these things that don't belong in places.
Susie in Pewaukee, your turn now. Hi, Susie.
Hi. See, I've had a bug on my kitchen window screen for the last 3 days, just hanging around. And I took my phone app that iNaturalist, took a photo of him, and it turns out he's a bald-faced hornet. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if he is, I mean, he seems to be alone all the time. So are they loners, and are they very dangerous, and could there be a nest nearby or whatever?
Sure. So first of all, it's a she, because bald-faced hornets at this time of the year pretty much are all females. That's typical of wasps. This is the big paper wasp, the one that makes the nest as big as a football or basketball. And why the critter's there, that's, again, a sign of something that's under stress and probably a weakened condition, because it should be going out catching prey and bringing it back to feed its young. It's most likely a worker. It's a little early to expect. So, yeah, nothing to worry about. And, again, because there's no nest there, it will be very non-aggressive. And the nest could be 20 feet in a tree, you know, 150 yards from your house. So there really is nothing to worry about there. Generally, bald-faced hornets, as long as they don't start a nest right in front of your front door or something, we don't have to worry about. And as I said, people run, you know, when they get up on ladders trying to treat some of these nests, or I remember one of the more infamous phone calls, I was talking with a gentleman where there was one on an overhanging street light. And as we're talking, I heard him just kind of cry out, and I heard this big bang. His neighbor came out with a shotgun and shot the nest. And there was a bunch of kids watching, and so now we've got a bunch of very angry wasps, and kids were getting stung. I mean, it was just an absolute nightmare, you know, to sit on the phone listening to this happen. And as I said, it was in a place that if we could have sat and chatted about it, just leave it alone, because it's not in a place that it's going to be threatening to anybody. So,
on that happy note, we're out of time. Phil, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us today. We'll look forward to your next visit.
Sounds good, Larry.
Phil Pelletieri, entomologist, distinguished faculty associate emeritus at UW-Madison. Great to have him with us. He'll be back. Talk with him again. Tomorrow we'll talk with our vehicle maintenance expert about the differences between and the pros and cons of synthetic and conventional oils. Hope you can join us for that starting at 11 tomorrow. But in the meantime, hey, stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mehler.